You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Fran reading the Saturday Sun. And we're looking at the date of April 11th. And the main story on the front page is described as a tragedy. There's a large photo of attorney Thomas Mixon, M-I-X-O-N, and his client, Sebastian DeGout. That's D-E, capital G-O-U-T, says 39 years of age. It shows them appearing in Middlesex Superior Court on April 8th, where DeGould pleaded guilty to stabbing his mother, as the photo says, during a psychotic episode. A smaller color photo also on that same front page shows Judge Chris Barry-Smith as he speaks to attorney Bailey Weese, W-E-E-S-E, who is not pictured. It just shows Judge Barry-Smith. This article is by Aaron Curtis. Gives his email address of acurtis@lowellsun.com, acurtis@lowellsun.com, and Dateline Lowell. Says nearly 2 years after she begged a New York court to intervene as her son slipped into dangerous, untreated psychosis, Rosa DeGout watched as that same son, whom she called a stranger created by psychosis, pleaded guilty on Wednesday past to stabbing her approximately 10 times inside her Draycott apartment. Sebastian DeGout, 39 years of age, diagnosed in late adolescence with both bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, was sentenced in Middlesex Superior Court to 3 to 6 years in prison for a vicious and sudden attack inside his mother's 18th Street apartment, March 15, 2025. That assault left Rosa with stab and slash wounds across her body, requiring more than 250 stitches to close, and it resulted in her being placed in a medically induced coma for 4 days. Despite the severity of the attack, Rosa told the court she did not want her son, quote, just punished, unquote, but to finally get placed somewhere where he could get help that he needs. She said the charge of attempted murder that Sebastian faces today is, in reality, the clinical manifestation of a biological break from reality, a tragic outcome that belongs to the illness, not the son I raised. This is a quote from Rosa in her statement to Judge Barry-Smith. She continued, while his actions were violent, my physical injuries cannot compare to the emotional heartbreak of this ordeal. I forgave my son immediately because I know the person who attacked me was a stranger created by psychosis. Sebastian's actions were a symptom, not a choice, end quote. Rosa said she spent years watching her son's mental state deteriorate, from hallucinations and delusions to periods of wandering and paranoia, but she said she was blocked by legal thresholds that prevented her from forcing him into treatment. In May 2024, she filed a petition in New York, warning that Sebastian was living in his car, not eating or sleeping, and showing signs of paranoia and psychosis. Despite her affidavit describing him as a danger to himself and others, she said a judge released him without a psychiatric evaluation. She continues, quoting her again, by failing to mandate clinical stabilization then, the court essentially guaranteed that Sebastian would remain in a state of escalating untreated psychosis until a crisis occurred. I was forced to watch my son drown because the lifeguards of our legal and medical systems are barred from jumping in until the person is already underwater, end quote. At the end of February 2025, Sebastian moved in with Rosa in Draken. She said, noting that he had been, quote, homeless and malnourished, end quote, and that she felt a flicker of hope when he returned, a hope that vanished by March 4th as he spiraled into delusion about ancient worlds and spirits. According to Rosa, she faced similar barriers in Massachusetts that she had in New York, where involuntary commitment laws require evidence of, quote, likelihood of serious harm, end quote, which is a threshold she could not meet even as his delusions escalated. Rosa said her son's unaddressed mental health issues culminated in that violent attack of March 15, 2025, and she noted in her statement, again quoting her, the tragedy that has brought us here today was not an accident. It was a predictable outcome that could have been prevented if the system had listened to a mother's plea. During Wednesday's hearing, Middlesex District Attorney, or Assistant District Attorney, Bailey Weese, W-E-E-S-E, detailed the brutal assault, saying that Sebastian had been watching television while Rosa was on the phone with her sister, when he suddenly approached her and stabbed her repeatedly all over her body with a knife. Quoting Weiss, the victim screamed at the defendant and asked what was wrong with him, but the defendant said nothing in return and continued the attack on his mother. According to a Draken police incident report, Rosa's sister later told investigators that out of the blue, her sibling began screaming through the phone and pleaded with her to call the police. The call was then disconnected. The sister tried calling back but could not reach her. Although she was in New York, she immediately contacted authorities in an attempt to get Rosa help. Police said that after the attack, Sebastian left the apartment on foot while Rosa sought help by banging on a neighbor's door. Neighbors attempted to stop the bleeding by tying sweatshirts around her wounds. Police said the then 55-year-old woman suffered at least 10 wounds, including puncture wounds to her back, abdomen, arm, and leg. Attorney Weiss told Judge Barry Smith that Rosa also suffered a broken lower jawbone from being punched by Sebastian, and a laceration to her neck that was 5 to 6 inches long and spanned from her ear to the front of her throat. Weiss continues, as a result of the laceration to her throat, one of the victim's vocal cords was severed, causing her to have permanent, lifelong problems with speaking, end quote. Shortly after the attack, Sebastian was found by police walking in the area of Methuen Street and Beacon Street. He surrendered without resistance and willingly informed officers that the knife they sought was in his pants pocket. According to police, the multicolored metallic folding knife recovered from Sebastian had blood on it, while Sebastian himself had bloodstains on his hands, pants, and behind his right ear. Sebastian's attorney, Thomas Mixon, again M-I-X-O-N, said his client had been prescribed psychiatric medications at the time of the attack, but was not taking them. The attorney added that Sebastian has expressed remorse. He was ultimately charged with armed assault with intent to murder, mayhem, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon causing serious bodily injury, and assault and battery, according to court records. Following his arraignment in Lowell District Court days after the attack, prosecutors requested a dangerousness hearing under Section 58A, after which a judge ordered Sebastian held without bail. Mixon said that Sebastian was initially held at the Billerica House of Correction, but was ultimately transferred to Bridgewater State Hospital because of the level of psychiatric care that he required. Given the mental health concerns in the case, including those raised by Rosa herself, Mixon sought a criminal responsibility evaluation. He said the defense expert concluded that Sebastian was not criminally responsible due to his mental illness. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office obtained its own expert report, which Mixon said spanned 38 pages, and still did not reach a definitive conclusion either way. So with these details in mind, Mixon said both sides began to work toward a resolution. The prosecution sought a sentence that would amount to 13 to 15 years in state prison, followed by 5 years of supervision, in exchange for guilty pleas to the four charges. The top charges in the indictment, armed assault with intent to murder and mayhem, both cover and carry maximum sentences of up to 20 years in prison. Mixon asked for a sentence of 2 to 3 years with an additional 3 years of supervision. Judge Barry Smith ultimately imposed a sentence of 3 to 6 years in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised probation. As the conditions of that supervision, Sebastian must undergo a mental health evaluation, comply with all recommended treatment, and complete a substance abuse evaluation and random screenings. He is also permitted to have contact with his mother so long as there is no abuse. The two have been prohibited from communicating since the attack under a no-contact order issued early in the case. As the judge handed down the sentence on Wednesday, members of Sebastian's family, including his mother, watched the hearing via Zoom. Judge Barry Smith said a letter from Sebastian's sister, as well as Rose's statement, were very impactful to his decision. Mixon said Sebastian has been placed at Old Colony Correctional Center, a medium security prison in Bridgewater that houses inmates with mental health needs. He noted that depending on Sebastian's clinical condition, he could be transferred back to Bridgewater State Hospital for additional treatment. Under state law, Sebastian will be eligible for parole after serving 2/3 of his 3 to 6 year sentence. Earlier in her statement, Rosa reflected on becoming Sebastian's mother at 16 years of age, recalling, "I remember looking into his eyes and promising to love and protect him, not realizing that I was just a child raising a child." She said she described him as a comedian, a gifted dancer, and a sharp dresser, the light of every party, and adored by his siblings. Acting as both mother and father, she said she never excused his mistakes, believing that holding him accountable when he was young would help prevent life-altering ones later. She continues, quoting her, "When under proper care, Sebastian returns to the loving brother, uncle, nephew, grandson, friend, and son he really is. I lost my voice on March 15th, but I found it today to ensure that the system hears a mother's pleas and not repeat what it ignored in the past." That was the main story on the front. Continuing Saturday's Sun from April 11th, still on the front page, an article from the Beacon Hill State House Producer by Colin Young is entitled "Bill Would Boost the Environment and Ban Single-Use Plastic Bags." We're back on that same thing again. Senate plans to vote next week on a policy-heavy $3.64 billion environmental borrowing bill that looks to pump state money into climate resilience improvements, land conservation efforts, clean water, and more. The bill that emerged Wednesday morning from the Senate Ways and Means Committee, which was number S-3050, would also ban single-use plastic carry-out bags at all retailers and impose a 10-cent fee for recyclable paper bags. It's set to be debated and passed on Wednesday, April 15th. According to Senate President Karen Spilka's office in a statement, while she cited the Sierra Club of Massachusetts, Massachusetts residents likely use more than 2 billion plastic bags every year, and a plastic bag tossed to the side of a road can pose immediate risks such as the suffocation or starvation of wildlife, while also fragmenting over time into microplastics that pollute. The Senate Ways and Means Committee bill would only allow retailers to give customers reusable bags, and in parentheses here, ones that are made of machine washable cloth, fabric, hemp, or other non-plastic fibers and have thread-stitched handles, end of parentheses, or recycled paper carry-out bags. The bill makes mention of providing no-cost reusable bags to low-income communities and people receiving state benefits. Recycled paper bags would carry a 10-cent fee, with proceeds split evenly between a new state plastics environmental protection fund and the retailer. Exemptions are authorized for certain small businesses with a single location and 10 or fewer employees, and for nonprofits and organizations like food pantries that distribute food or clothes for free or at reduced prices. The bill's single-use plastic provisions would extend beyond bags and into disposable utensils and other food service products. Retailers would be prohibited from providing things like plastic forks, straws, coffee stirrers, cup sleeves, hinge-to-go containers, and more, unless they are requested by the consumer. The Senate approved similar single-use plastic restrictions, including a bag ban in 2019 that never emerged for a vote in the House, and another one in 2024 that met the same fate. Many cities and towns, in fact 163 as of November 2024, and of course according to the Sierra Club, already regulate single-use plastic shopping bags at the local level. Again, House Speaker Mariano said, quoting him, "We've always sort of stayed away from a statewide mandate because we felt that there was a bit of a burden on small businesses and mom-and-pop stores that populate some of our big cities. We wanted to give each city and town the opportunity to decide for themselves. So we'll take a look at what they send over and what the standards are for implementing the ban," end quote. The bond authorizations in the bill serve as a wish list of sorts, since the state is limited in how much it can borrow each year. Under the current five-year capital plan, a total of $1.18 billion is allocated for energy and environment borrowing. On the bonding side of the bill, the Senate is eyeing a $500 million for the Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program, which provides money for cities and towns to build climate resilience into public works projects. That's up from the $315 million proposed by Governor Healey when it got the bond bill rolling last June. The Senate Ways and Means Committee again seeks to chip away at the issue, this time with a $450 million for the Massachusetts Clean Water Trust to protect access to clean water across the state, and another $120 million specifically for PFAS remediation in public and private wells. Senator Julian Sir, that's CYR, the chief sponsor of a long-discussed PFAS response omnibus bill, said last week, quoting him, "I think this chamber really led the way also in appropriating significant dollars to DEP and the Clean Water Trust to address this issue. So, Mr. President, I hope we can continue that proud tradition of addressing PFAS. I'm eager and hungry for us to keep working on this thorny issue. It has many, many broad areas." The Senate, end quote. The Senate also slightly upped the governor's recommended amount of borrowing to fund upgrades at the Department of Conservation and Recreation properties, erasing her $764 million in favor of $789 million for DCR, that's the Department of Conservation and Recreation. Senators are also looking to be more generous when it comes to money for state and municipal-owned dams, authorizing $521.6 million compared with Healey's question for $401 million. The legislation also approves borrowing $130 million for the Food Security Infrastructure Grant Program, including $5 million for the Massachusetts Food Trust Program that ensures access to healthy, affordable food. There's a $200 million authorization for coastal infrastructure and resilience, $125.5 million to support resource conservation and preservation initiatives like the Healthy Soils Grant Program, $50 million for the Mass Trail Grants, with $10 million set aside for accessibility upgrades to trails, $30 million for tree planting initiatives across the state, $20 million for capital investments to support the growth and economic competitiveness of Massachusetts's agricultural, commercial fishing, and cranberry growing sectors, and $15 million for a pilot program to advance the deployment of geothermal energy technology. It also stretches into housing, with $50 million to capitalize a revolving residential production fund through mass housing for mixed income or workforce multi-family housing. The Senate bill would create a number of new commissions and funds as well. The Quabbin Host Community Trust Fund would support the services, public safety, and development of municipalities within the Quabbin Reservoir watershed. There would be a commission on flood risk mitigation and resilience in the Connecticut River Valley. A resilience revolving fund would function as a low-interest loan program for municipalities. And there would be a special legislative commission to study and recommend solutions for essential wastewater infrastructure improvements in response to nitrogen pollution in southeastern Massachusetts. At the end of this rather complex article, it states that Colin Young is the deputy editor for State House News Service and State Affairs Pro Massachusetts, and he can be reached at colin.young@statehousenews.com. That's colin.young@statehousenews.com. There was a lot of complication in that, lots of figures. Might be worthwhile to try to get a direct contact. Still on the front page, at the top of the page, House passes youth social media ban. This also is a State House News Service article, and it's by Ella Adams. It said, Massachusetts House Wednesday passed a bill restricting social media use for children and banning student cell phone use during the school day, adding language aimed at addressing addictive feeds and protecting certain vulnerable groups. The bill, which is number S2581 as amended, passed on a 129-25 vote. Democratic Representatives Erica Uytehoven, that's Uytehoeven, and Mike Connolly voted against the bill, along with the majority of the Republican caucus. Republican Representatives Norman Orall, O-R-R-A-L-L, and Marcus Vaughn cast votes in favor of the legislation. Education Committee Chair Representative Ken Gordon is quoted as saying, this is a matter of protecting our children with regard to public health. It's a matter of standing up to big tech, just as we stood up to big tobacco in the past. He said this in a speech on the House floor. The bill prohibits social media use for children under 14 and requires that social media platforms obtain parental consent for users aged 14 and 15. Gordon is again quoted as saying, when we talk about restricting social media access for children, we're responding to a growing body of evidence from trusted institutions that have carefully studied these effects, end quote. Should the law pass, Massachusetts would be the 18th state to place a ban on restriction on children's access to social media, adding that 8 states have passed laws requiring various forms of age verification, parental consent, or like ours, and now we're speaking, we're quoting Gordon again, and like ours, a combination of the two, end quote. The bill leans on the Attorney General to write regulations for implementation, and purposely does not restrict any particular social media platform. House and Ways Minutes Committee Chair Aaron Mikulicz said after a closed Democratic caucus early in the afternoon. Representatives Wednesday evening added that language requiring platforms to prohibit a user 14 or 15 years of age from using, again, quote, addictive social media feeds, end quote, which the bill defines as content provided by a platform employing algorithms that, again, quoting here, analyze user data or information on users to select content, end quote, for them, including features like infinite scrolling, push notifications or alerts, autoplay video, and display of personal interactive metrics. Language was also added to require social media companies to set default safety settings to prioritize the health and wellness of users 14 and 15 years of age, including settings that restrict visibility, sharing, and direct messaging to, quote, connected accounts, end quote. The bill defines those accounts as being, again, quote here, directly connected to the user's account, including, but not limited to, a friend, follower, or similar connection with access to view the user's content, end quote. Under the bill, platforms can't send notifications to 14 and 15-year-olds between the hours of 12 a.m. and 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Representative Alice Peisch, P-E-I-S-C-H, said that research increasingly links early social media use to anxiety, depression, diminished self-esteem, and worse. A social media ban for children under 14 is not extreme. It's responsible. We set age limits for driving, for voting, for working, for alcohol consumption, and the digital world should be no exception. Her bill, which is numbered H666, included the concepts behind the social media portion of the bill. Again, according to Peisch, the bill also establishes a transitional period from ages 14 to 16 in which children can access social media with their parents' permission and gives parents some ability to monitor that access, end quote. Concerns arose early Wednesday that provisions in the bill enabling parents to request access to their children's user data could potentially harm LGBTQ youth who often find safe spaces in online communities. This is according to Ms. Uytehaven. Senator Montano filed an amendment to the bill that would ensure no data submitted by users was made available to a parent or a guardian prior to the bill's effective date. Quoting him, "It's an LGBTQ safety thing. We don't want kids to get outed," he said this ahead of the session. "I understand the impetus of the bill. I understand the concern. Like most things, there are unintended consequences for some people if you're not the average neurotypical kid." End quote. Representatives added language Wednesday in a consolidated amendment that, again, quoting here, recognizes that there should be some limits on the monitoring in order to protect certain vulnerable populations, end quote. According to Ms. Peisch, a section of the House bill now reads that no social media platform shall share any data related to a minor user and their LGBTQ plus protected status or any other protected status pursuant to Chapter 151B. End quote. A consolidated amendment also added to provisions enabling parents to request access to data submitted by their child that also, again quoting here, no social media platform shall provide data other than what was submitted for the purposes of verifying the age of the user. Across the country, the industry has challenged social media age verification laws, often on First Amendment rights concerns. Progressives, Ms. Rita Hyman and Mr. Connolly, raised data privacy concerns when asked about their dissenting votes. It's not like, oh, maybe it will leak or maybe not. It's an inevitability. Having to prove whether you're a certain age using a government-issued ID or facial recognition, all of those methods, we know that there's been several leaks that have happened. This quote that I've just mentioned is, again, from Representative Uitenhoven. And she continued, the fact that we put in no guardrails around that is a massive privacy and data security issue, end quote. According to bill language, social media platforms should be required to implement an age assurance or verification system to determine whether a current or a prospective user on the social media platform meets the age requirement. That system would consist of the best technology available to reasonably and accurately identify a current or a prospective user's age. This is according to the bill text. While Representative Connolly supports banning the use of social media for young kids, he said that legislation would require all people to verify their age and that big tech would be permitted to retain your government IDs or maybe even your biometric data. This is just another area where we're really opening up the footprint of big tech, end quote. Should the bill go to conference committee, as is currently anticipated, the Senate would then have to determine whether to go along with the social media aspect of the proposal, which was not addressed in the version of the bill, which was number 2581 at the time, that cleared the chamber back in July, which was 38-2 result, and that would ban cell phones for students throughout the school day. If we look at the local news page for a minute, we have at the top of the page an article by Kathy Register. There's no mention of who that is or from where, but there is a small photo, a black and white photo, of performer and poet Anthony Febo participating in a full-day Arts Elevate training program back in August of last year. That's spelled F-E-B-O. Dateline Lowell. If you prepare a meal, does that make you a chef? Must one be an artist to be creative? Can only poets write poems? These are questions performer and poet Anthony Febo asked middle school students as part of his spoken word poetry program. This was with the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Lowell. He says, in my workshops, it's not so much this is how to write a good poem. It's less about a craft, per se, and more about, hey, you already have it in you to write poems. He explained this, and he's from Rhode Island. He is based there. He uses this and his last name only professionally. He said that his after-school pottery program was created for Arts Elevate. Poetry program was created for Arts Elevated, which is a pilot project supported by Greater Lowell Community Foundation and designed to improve the health and wellness of adolescents in Greater Lowell. He said, quoting him, one of the beautiful things about writing is that while it can't change what happens, it can change the way we feel about what happens. He has previously lived and worked in Lowell. He also added that these workshops are not overtly about mental health. It's more about inviting young people to write about what they feel. Basically, we're having conversations around what things are on their minds and in their hearts. Then we explore how to bring those things to the page or to the stage. Launched in the fall, this pilot project titled Arts Elevate said embedded community artists for youth wellness in Greater Lowell placed four artists in 12-week residencies at nonprofit organizations in Acton, Concord, Broughton, and Lowell. And at Lowell, it was at the Boys and Girls Club. And this is according to the Community Foundation Vice President of Marketing, Programs, and Strategy, Jennifer Aradhia, A-R-A-D-H-Y-A. The Arts Elevate initiative was developed for Greater Lowell with lead funding from the Barr Foundation through its Creative Commonwealth Initiative. Ms. Aradhia said, Febo's approach perfectly captures what Arts Elevate is all about, meeting young people where they are and giving them tools to process their experiences. When we talk about promoting youth wellness through creative engagement, spoken word poetry is one of the most direct pathways. These students are literally giving voice to what's inside them. Juan Carlos Rivera, who's deputy executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Lowell, agrees. And quoting him, this spoken word program is a lot about building relationships and making sure young people feel comfortable and willing to try something outside their comfort zone, like poetry. That comfortable foundation is what we want to create. The kids might say, who's this new guy? He's interesting. Then they might have a conversation with Phoebo that has nothing to do with poetry, and they feel heard. It can take off from there. Every young person wants a platform to be heard. End quote. The Boys and Girls Club of Greater Lowell serves children ages 8 to 18, primarily from Lowell, Draken, and Chelmsford, according to Rivera. He says, quoting him again, we have more than 1,000 kids registered, with 180 to 200 attending per day. Most programs run from 2 to 8 p.m., Monday through Friday, with some special events scheduled for the weekends. But he says we're mainly an after-school program. And offering a wide variety of activities, the Boys and Girls Club focuses on four target areas: academics, life and workforce, character and leadership, and healthy lifestyles. They can be sports kids or a young person who is into the arts, and they can find something they like here. But ideally, we want them to cross over. I really like to have my basketball players, writing poetry. End quote. Working with so many young people who can be dropping into a number of different programs each week requires flexibility on his part, said Phoebo. He first envisioned his Arts Elevate curriculum as a series of four monthly master classes, but the poet quickly realized he wanted to be on site more often. He said, at first, my schedule was once a month. Then I opted to being there 2 to 3 times a month, and now I'm going in 3 or 4 times a month. Designed for teens ages 13 to 16, his workshops attracted students in 8th grade up through high school, so his enrollment varied daily and weekly. However, he had a core group of about 6 regulars. Phoebo keeps his workshops low-key and low-pressure. He said, I recognize this Boys and Girls Club series is not necessarily a writing program. There's a big difference between working with young people who are choosing to be in a workshop to write versus those that are just coming after school as part of a larger program. However, he says, we can pull out poetry from our lives in all kinds of ways, so we don't spend a lot of time talking about metaphors and symbolism. We just do it. And afterwards I might say, do you realize you created a great metaphor there? End quote. This 12-week spoken word poetry program culminated in a final performance in December when Phoebo performed and also opened the stage to students who wanted to perform their own poems. Ideally, Arts Elevated will have legs and continue to help others in the future, according to Ms. Aradia. She says, what makes Phoebo's work at the Boys and Girls Club particularly valuable is how it translates to the toolkit we're building. His flexible relationship-first approach shows other organizations that embedded artist programs don't have to be rigid. They can adapt to the rhythms and needs of each unique setting while still achieving meaningful wellness outcomes. Rivera said that at the end of this program, I'll be thrilled if our young people have some level of understanding of spoken word poetry. Plus, hopefully, in finding themselves along the way through this series, they'll be able to process their own thoughts and feelings. He said, in some cases, if they don't stop to identify what's happening in their bodies or what they're feeling as teenagers, ultimately, that could all come out when they're adults, and maybe in not such healthy ways. It's much better that they learn how to combat that confusion now. For more information about the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Lowell, please visit lbgc.org. Just simply lbgc.org. And for more information about the Greater Lowell Community Foundation Arts Elevate Program, please visit the glcfoundation.org/arts-elevate. That's glcfoundation.org/arts-elevate. And we have still the 5-minute read from the local news section. This time we see a note here from Littleton. It says, Opportunity Outreach Initiative is a youth-led nonprofit focused on expanding global awareness and educational opportunities for students in the community. Hamsika Pratapa, that's H-A-M-S-I-K-A, P-R-A-T-A-P-A, a junior at Littleton High School and co-president of the organization, says that our organization works with local elementary level students by connecting them with pen pals in countries like India, South Africa, and China, and delivering interactive presentations to increase their global awareness. The group introduces students to topics such as cultural differences, education systems around the world, and the realities many children face in accessing schooling and basic resources. Students are encouraged to actively engage through writing, discussion, and direct communication with peers in other parts of the world. The nonprofit also raises funds to support underfunded schools and children in other countries. These funds help provide essential resources that directly impact students' ability to attend school and succeed academically. Ms. Prabhupada said that 001 has worked with more than 100 students and raised $5,000. For more information, you can go online to outreachinitiative.org. Just as it sounds, outreachinitiative.org. And we see a group of two young ladies here. They're not named, but we see them at a setup where apparently a booth describing much of what they have been doing and looking to pass out information. It says they are a youth-led, again, nonprofit focused on expanding global awareness and educational opportunities for students in the community. And from the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, we have an announcement that it will be conducting overnight construction and resurfacing operations along various locations along Route 3 northbound and southbound between Burlington and Tingsboro. The work will begin Sunday, April 12th, scheduled to be conducted weekly from Sunday through Thursday during overnight hours from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. the following morning, and occasional work on Friday evenings as needed. The work will require temporary lane closures to allow crews to conduct construction and resurfacing operations safely and effectively, including milling and paving, drainage structure improvements, guardrail improvements, bridge repairs, and pavement markings. This is part of a $20.6 million pavement improvement project along Route 3. Signage, law enforcement details, and message boards will be in place to guide drivers through the work area. Also, April's from Lowell, April's Art in City Hall show, which is called Art Thou Neurodivergent. This will showcase the work of neurodivergent students, and it runs through Tuesday, April 28th. Again, this is in City Hall. The show is called Art Thou Neurodivergent, and it showcases works of neurodivergent students running through Tuesday, April 28th. And one more article from the opinion page. The commentary is written by Ronald L. Walker II. It's entitled Career Pathways Uplifts Job Outlook for High Schoolers. Every student deserves a clear path to a fulfilling career no matter where they live or go to school. The Career Pathways program of Campus Without Walls creates a sought-after bridge between our Massachusetts high school students and their future careers. Increasingly, research and feedback involving students, parents, and educators have revealed the value to students when schools provide exposure to potential careers. As recently reported in an Education Week series entitled High School Handoff, educators and policymakers are increasingly challenged to meet that need. Career Pathways is an exciting, accessible, and cost-effective answer. Campus Without Walls reimagines public education by connecting schools, educators, and industry partners across Massachusetts. Through a live virtual credit-bearing course exchange paired with the real-world work-based learning, CWW enables students to access advanced coursework, industry design modules, and authentic employer engagement, regardless of their zip code or school. Our guiding statement is simple and bold. One state, one classroom, endless possibilities. Campus Without Walls and the Career Pathways program enable students to remain in their home schools while zooming live into courses taught by the state's best educators and earning credit toward graduation, while teachers gain meaningful leadership opportunities and districts expand their variety of course offerings to meet students' passions and interests. CWW courses cover in-demand fields and innovative topics such as green chemistry, Spanish for healthcare, phlebotomy certification, biotechnology, robotics, and entrepreneurship. The Career Pathways program benefits students and schools by providing access to advanced and industry-aligned coursework, enabling cross-school collaboration and shared projects, connecting students directly with employers and real-world experience, fostering autonomy in pursuing courses aligned with personal interests. And as part of this initiative, Career Pathways has developed a mini module course of offerings in collaboration with industry partners. These mini modules bring real-world expertise directly into the classroom. Industry professionals zoom into teacher-led classes to provide live interactive instruction, enhancing the curriculum with practical career-focused learning experiences. This model ensures that students gain exposure to high-demand industries while remaining fully supported by their classroom teachers. The specialized Career Pathways mini-modules provided by industry partners to enrich the classroom experience includes, for example, Harvard Med Science Mission Diagnosis, a 3-day shift in the ER. From Emmanuel College, Life on You, Microbes, Medicine, and Mind. From the Certified Financial Advisory Society, Investing 101, Smart Money Moves for Teens. From Citizens Bank, Financial Literacy and Career Pathways in Banking. And Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship, program called Next Level Startup, and from the Franklin Cummings Technical Institute, a program Intro to Cybersecurity, and from Digital Ready, a program entitled Digital Skills for the Modern Workforce. In the 2026 to 2027 school year, CWW will launch its pilot phase with 10 schools across 6 districts, stretching from the heart of Boston to Western Mass. That launch builds upon years of development that offered professional development for educators and built school-to-industry partnerships. The schools participating in the pilot program are Codman Academy Charter Public School, Collaboration for Educational Services, Frontier Regional High School, Greater Eggleston High School, Boston Public Schools, Hadley Public Schools, which would be Hopkins Academy, Holland Tech, Boston Public Schools, they are part of, Innovation Academy Charter School, New Mission High School, which is also part of Boston Public Schools, Phoenix Charter Academy Network, part of Chelsea and Springfield, and Tech Boston Academy, which is part of the Boston Public Schools. Liberty Mutual Foundation recently awarded a collaborative impact planning grant to Campus Without Walls, Action for Boston Community Development, and Boston Private Industry Council to scale the virtual career pathways model across Greater Boston for high school students and young adults 16 to 24, ensuring broader access to career-aligned learning. They call this citywide initiative Workforce Innovation through Remote Education, or they use the acronym WIRE, W-I-R-E. Past and present CWW founders include the Redstone Family Foundation, the Boston Foundation, Liberty Mutual Foundation, New Schools Venture Fund, Treffler Foundation, that's T-R-E-F-L-E-R, Eastern Bank Foundation, Cabot Charitable Trust, American Student Assistance Foundation, Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, Nellie May Education Foundation, Brightbound, that's B-R-I-T-E-B-O-U-N-D, OutSchool, and Advanced Evidence Improving Lives. Those were all programs or part of funders of the CWW program. Ronald W. Walker, who is the second, is the interim director and strategic advisor of Campus Without Walls and CEO of the Walker Group. He developed and oversees the Career Pathways Program. He's former Massachusetts Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development in the Charlie Baker administration. He brings to CWW decades of experience in banking, finance, and advancing education, innovation, economic growth, and equity. And he is committed to ensuring that he is in every student giving access to a pathway that aligns with their interests and career aspirations.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.